When we look around us, these feelings of being disempowered or unrepresented, this feeling of grievance has, if anything, become more prevalent all around the world.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. When citizens demand change, and when they feel they're not being heard, then they go to the streets and protest. Well, thanks to social media and TV coverage, these days we see protests every night on the news. But has the frequency or the character of these protests changed? And what don't we know about these protests? What would it be useful to find out? David Yang of Harvard and Noam Yuchtman of the University of Oxford are two of the authors of a new review of the literature on protests, and they join me now. David, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And Noam, welcome as well.
Thank you.
So, Noam, in this age, I mentioned social media, and you go online now and everyone's protesting about something all of the time, it seems. So why are protests that involve people on the street, why is that important to study?
I think it's important to be clear about what is different about going onto the street. So we have the opportunity in some countries to vote. And as you say, we have opportunities to vent online, but taking to the street is something different. So relative to voting, even in a democracy, minorities don't have control over policy and can feel disempowered or unrepresented. Even in democracies, and certainly in other regimes, there may be a lack of confidence in the political system. And sometimes we simply have grievances, and voting and sometimes venting isn't sufficient to express that grievance. We need to take an action that is more meaningful to us, that might be costly to us, and that might be costly to others in order to successfully express that grievance in our political feeling. And I think especially when we look around us, these feelings of being disempowered or unrepresented, this feeling of grievance has, if anything, become more prevalent all around the world.
What is your definition of a protest? Does something have to be a certain size, or to be about something in particular, or to be organized in a particular way to qualify as a protest?
Speaking specifically about our review article,
yeah,
we are very broad. And we're broad in part because this allows us to take advantage of existing sources using the coding of others so that we don't cherry pick in a sense. But what we have in mind are political actions by groups of people outside of formal political system that express a particular demand, from a large scale strike that can demand working conditions that may change, demonstrations or rallies. So these can range in size and in objective, but they share a common element of collective action.
And one thing to note is that while the definition of protests and these activities are sort of conceptually clear, empirically it's much more challenging, particularly so not every single gatherings, not every single movements or activities where large amount of people gather on the streets to demand policy change gets observed in a way that we can see. There's going to be protests that are happening at times in spaces where we don't know it actually occurred. So this has to be sort of picked up by either social media, it has to pick up by traditional media one way or the other for us to be able to see it. So that's going to be one very important filtering or condition in the background of the empirical definition of protests.
So given this, who is collecting the data on protests? How are they collecting it? How can we have confidence that it is accurate and reliable?
It's a good question. And I think the answer depends a little bit, again, on purpose. So for the purposes of our review article, we wanted to highlight the possibility of exploiting big data to understand this type of political behavior. And in this case, the big data largely relies on media reporting and machine learning in order to code the content of media articles.
And this particular data that we primarily work with is called GDELT. It's a global event database, which is basically an automated procedure of capturing all type of events around the world. And that particular GDAL project is using machine learning to then categorize different events into different categories. And protests is one of such categories that we're interested in. There are several attempts of doing similar things aside from GDAL. So for various contexts, you can compare the coverage of GDAL. You can compare the extensiveness of that with either a global version. ACLI is another version that people have often used. And there's also sort of country-specific one that come with their own biases and sort of focus. I guess the short answer is no data set is perfect. GDAL is tend to be, especially in recent years, the more comprehensive version, but it sacrificed a bit on accuracy. So country-specific coverage on protests in particular, there sometimes are better database.
In this work that you're doing here, what's the scope? You are looking at the nature of protests, but also are you looking at whether protests are successful, whether they achieve their aims?
We don't get very far, to be perfectly honest. And I think there's at least one good reason for that that relates to how we study protests, which is individual protests are often part of a long-running movement. And a given protest event may not be in any sense the culmination of that movement, and yet it might keep a movement alive and keep people mobilized to the point that eventually a policy change can be achieved. And so I think trying to code the outcome of a protest as successful or not, at the very least, requires some perspective of time and the passage of time.
I think you were mostly referring to whether protest leads to actual changes in policy, actual changes in regimes, and so on.
That's what I was thinking, yes.
Which oftentimes is very difficult to define ex ante. In part, as Noam mentioned, many individual protest activities don't have a very specific aim in mind. They just induce change, or it might just simply be an event of discontent. And linking that to actual changes in policy or changes in political institution regimes is difficult. And then added was the dimension of oftentimes there's a time lag that if protests may not lead to immediate change, but it might have induced some softening of the political soil that 5 years later, things have changed. And do you attribute that change to the particular protest movement? So those type of questions are extremely important, but empirically much harder to define. Now, there is one definition of protest success that we can look at directly, and academic literature have looked at, and arguably sort of protest organizers also cared a lot about, which is whether protests even get started in the first place and how large a protest is. That cannot be taken for granted because there are obviously going to be a lot of protests that would have been too wanted to study but never generated momentum to get enough people on the streets. A protest that didn't last very long in terms of movement and so on. Those one can directly observe and in a more definitive way. And then arguably, as one definition of protest success without linking to policy change. And certainly we also see many examples where protests lead to backfire, that things become worse after the protests have organized, at least on the face value. So this is actually much more complicated than one would hope to be able to link a protest to a consequence or an outcome.
In the introduction, I said, well, it seems that there's protests all the time at the moment. Is my intuition correct? Are there more protests than there used to be?
To some extent, that is true. And that is something that we observe in the data. But in some ways, maybe it's a bit less true than I think our attention might suggest. So let me tell you that, you know, maybe it's surprisingly not true or needs to be qualified. We've had earlier spikes of protests that we pick up in our data. And a really important one is a spike in protests that we observe in the set of countries that we call autocracies and weak democracies. And that spike occurred around the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And in fact, we do see at this moment of democratic change a rise in protests exactly in these regions where democratization occurs. And that is an enormous spike in our data. We return to that in the post-Arab Spring, post-2011 age, in particular, again, in these autocracies and weak democracies, and a sense in which you're right, that maybe things have reached a different level in autocracies and weak democracies in particular, although we're no longer at the spike or high level seen just around the time of the Arab Spring. It seems in our data that the level of protests remains elevated, and that might suggest that we are at some new political level, at least in that set of countries.
Yes, that's what a lot of people remember as a big change in the nature of protest, the surprising nature of the Arab Spring. And you're saying that is reflected in the data.
There certainly seems to be a trend breaking that since Arab Spring, not only do protests become more prevalent, but also become differentially more prevalent among autocracies and weak democracies. Consistent with our intuition that since the rising of social media, protests become relatively potentially easier to organize and facilitate internal coordination. And that seems to be matched with what we observe around the world.
That's the other piece of conventional wisdom about the Arab Spring. The idea that social media made it possible to organize protests. Has social media had a similar effect on the nature of protests since?
So the work that I would refer to on that topic is not our review article, but a book by Zeynep Tufekci that very much makes this argument. Mm-hmm. The book is called Twitter and Tear Gas in a very evocative title. And the purpose is to dig exactly into the details of this mechanism linking social media to protest. I would say that her work makes a very strong argument, which matches what we see in the aggregate, which is that this type of coordination tool is especially valuable when there isn't free communication and where there isn't a free flow of information. That's precisely in weak democracies and autocracies. In a very well-developed democracy and a free society, we can coordinate to protest. We can communicate with each other. We can gather without fear. And that's something that allows for protest coordination and sort of movement consolidation. And social media provides that capacity, especially in these countries where it would otherwise be lacking. And so the Tufekci mechanisms match what we see in our aggregate data, I would say.
Tim, to your earlier question about linking protests to consequences, the fact that social media might have changed the nature of protests make this an even harder question to answer. So let me give you one intuition for this. There has been evidence showing that social media facilitated coordination that potentially makes protests otherwise wouldn't happen, relatively easy to happen on the streets, because people now can communicate with each other when and where protests will occur, and regimes have a relatively harder time to crack down those type of coordination attempts when it happened initially started on social media.
Yes.
Now, what this will entail is that in a social media age, there will be a lot more protests, and there will be a lot more protests that may be started on demands or on satisfaction that were relatively lower in stake compared to back in the days, where people have to be sufficiently unhappy. The regime had to be sufficiently doing unwelcoming policies for people to gather enough momentum to be able to get on the streets, which will mean that the changes and the size of protests might have actually decreased since the social media, because you actually see a lot of lower stake protests actually become fruitful on the streets where you don't see before. So once you're selected on the occurrence of protests, where you do see a lot more after social media, the average effectiveness, quote unquote, of the protests in the social media stage might actually decrease, because you only see the big and high stake and the desperate protests before social media stage. So that selection is, I think, is extremely important to keep in mind and very hard to study empirically, in fact, but that very much is a result of potential change in nature of protests and what technology makes coordination easier, the consequences of that.
Noam, you mentioned earlier when we were talking about how hard it is to link protests to what protests achieve, the idea that protests exist within the context of political movements. What do we mean by a political movement as distinct from a protest?
I'll answer it in two parts. So first, in general, I think what we mean is a movement as a collection of moments of political expression. And those moments may be street protests. They may involve other behaviors. They may involve the attempt to publicize a cause. They may involve some more formal organization. But oftentimes these movements, especially when there's an attempt to express the views of the otherwise unrepresented, will take the form of a sequence of protests. And in that sense, protests make up movements almost literally, in that individual events of expression are what link together become a movement. And yet what we would also say, I think, is that movements help to make protests, in that in many cases, the movement that represents a cause, a community of individuals, a set of ideas that motivate protest participation. And some work that David and I have done in Hong Kong suggests that it is in fact this sort of participation in one protest that then links to protest participation again, oftentimes through social interaction. And so the relationship between the existence of a movement and participation in protest, I think, is running in two directions. In the case of this review article, we needed to come up with a very formal definition for how we would define a movement within this big data set. And here we tried to be very conservative, actually, and we decided to link protest events as contiguous events over time or repeated events on the same date over multiple years. That conservative approach to identifying movements still led to a surprising number of events and some interesting patterns.
You can manage to create patterns within the data if you make this definition about the relationship between movements and protests?
Yeah, I'll just highlight a couple which maybe are surprising. When we look at protest movements, we see that there's a surprising number that really last a substantial amount of time, dozens of days, even under autocracies. And that surprised me, at least, relative to the idea that protests may be very quickly suppressed. And we also found some very interesting patterns when we thought about geographic diffusion, where, again, we might think about protests as really explosive political moments of expression, where you might have a movement that immediately reaches a peak in terms of geographic diffusion and then very quickly winds down or is repressed by an autocratic state. But in fact, we find really long leads prior to the maximal diffusion, and in some cases, relatively gradual declines from the peak. And that, I think, suggests patterns of interaction between protesters, maybe non-protesters who join, and the state that reacts. And those patterns of interactions are an area that we see a large amount of room for additional research, because we don't know that much about how these different groups interact with each other.
Both from a protest organizer's perspective, but also from the state's perspective, if the states would like to suppress protests, and certainly also from academic research perspective, differentiating those one-off activities, one-off events versus long-running, persistent engagement or quote-unquote movements is very important, because how do you mobilize people to get on the street just for once to maximize the size versus how do you mobilize and keep as a subgroup of the population continue to be engaged and coming back to the streets or stay on the streets for days or coming back every other Tuesday? Those are two very different mechanisms and probably require very different mobilization strategy or maybe mobilization technology, and oftentimes will involve very different type of people in terms of their preferences and commitments and so on. And we don't know which one is more quote-unquote effective and then more threatening from a regime's perspective, but we need to make a very strong conceptual distinction between one-off versus this continuous repeated activities, because both are definitely happening across the spectrum of protests around the world, and they will require very different focus in order to study them.
One thing that we continually witness is the efforts of autocracies to restrict protests against them, and that might be using those traditional methods of employing the police or employing the law to restrict the right to protest, or it might be by more novel methods like turning off the internet. It sounds like there is still a gap in our knowledge of exactly how successful this is, how these methods are deployed, what causes protests to decline.
There's still, I think, a lot of interesting work to be done. Mm-hmm. I think even starting with the question of at what point does the state repress? Because, of course, there is some interesting work, for example, by political scientist Peter Lorentzen, arguing that authoritarian governments can learn from protests that are allowed to take place precisely because otherwise an autocrat may not be able to observe grievances. And I think this is something very interesting, that we can think about autocrats as tolerating protest up to a point, and at that point, potentially trying to limit protests. When it comes to limiting protests, it can do so by trying to prevent them from occurring in the first place. And David and I, again, have done a little bit of work suggesting that the rollout of facial recognition, AI, and surveillance cameras can play a role in limiting protests. And then, of course, there's the question of what to do after protests actually arise. And again, there are questions of when should a state concede or negotiate, and when should a state crack down? And sometimes it's not a state, but as we've seen on university campuses around the Western world, there's a question of at what point do university administrators negotiate or crack down, and what are the consequences of those choices?
I will say that sort of the toolkits that is available to the state, especially autocratic states, is likely a lot wider than what we have known in the academic literature already. So give you one example, the pretty amazing work by my colleague, Jia Wen at HBS has done, and she showed that when the Chinese state is interested or potentially incentivized to keep certain subgroup of population off the street, they mobilize or they coordinate the state sector to employ those very individuals. And that act as a very strong incentive to link those individuals' sort of career incentive and their long-run payments in terms of their labor payments to their staying off the streets, because that's going to act as a very credible and very powerful stick to keep them off. And sort of how does the employment and sort of the entire labor market, at least part of the labor market where the states can have direct control over, might be used to keep people off the streets in certain contexts? Those are toolkits and type of tools that one normally would not necessarily associate with the direct protest suppression technology that are just simply using police or using sort of brute force or fear. So I think there's a lot more to detect and study across the autocracies on that front.
We've talked a lot about protests as an expression of values, but what about protests against poverty, against unemployment, against economic factors like that? Are economic factors a good predictor of the likelihood of people protesting?
There are clearly cases of mobilization in response to economic demands.
Yeah.
Whether these are strikes, most basically organized by groups of workers, or whether they're expressions of dissatisfaction with inequality and policies to alleviate it, like the Occupy movement and protests against austerity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that economic forces and economic grievances can mobilize people to protest and make demands of the state. I think what is interesting in our review article is that although some economic approaches to protest would really prioritize economics and economic variables, we actually find that economic variables at the country level mm-hmm. are not such strong predictors of protest prevalence.
There are many countries and there are many periods in which there are economic grievances and economic downturns. Not every one of them turn into large public collective actions against that.
Yeah.
In other words, one might consider economic grievances or many of the economic incentive to protest, which will require policy change that try to alleviate those economic grievances, is a necessary condition, perhaps in the background, for people to be mobilized. But it's definitely not sufficient for us to observe protest activities, because there are definitely way more incidents where people should have economic incentive to change policy or use protest as a way to express their discontent. But many of them don't translate into actual action. So that requires sort of additional forces that require a protest organization, that requires sort of successful coordination, the right set of people potentially to collectively share such discontent at a particular moment. And there could be also a lot of idiosyncratic episodes where protests get sparked out of some oftentimes very salient tragedies where those coordination happens. So economic grievances, the way we understand it, is something that happened in the background that would provide a reason for policy change, but you would need a lot more for protest action to occur.
So look at it from the other end. What about individuals who are protesting? What do we know about what makes individuals likely to protest? Is it an expression of their personality traits or their attitudes, their preferences?
I think one of the arguments we want to make in our review article, based on the aggregate data that we present there, but building also on a much more focused study of protesters in Hong Kong, is that protesters, at least to us, appear consistently to be pro-social types of people, where pro-sociality is measured using elicitations regarding altruism, regarding how reciprocal people are, regarding their support for redistribution. What we found across years of surveys of Hong Kong University students is that whether the protests in Hong Kong were large or small, pro-sociality predicted protest participation. And in our aggregate analysis in the review article, we find very similar evidence, which is, I think, to us, a very reassuring level of consistency. And I think is different from what people might have expected from some images of protesters and protests, especially as they get large. It's not antisocial, destructive types who are participating in these movements. On average, it's the pro-social types.
That's completely different to the story that many governments would tell you about protesters.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's not to say that sort of pro-social types wouldn't take potentially non-peaceful or violent actions to achieve their goal. So that's going to be, in many cases, and including Hong Kong, the unfortunate sort of development of the protest movement. But the intuition that everyone will benefit from a successful protest movement, but why would some people take on potentially high personal cost, both effort and time, and sometimes also facing direct risk of personal safety to go on the streets and demand such change, that oftentimes will require some degree of pro-sociality and commitments and some risk aversion to do so. And that probably is on top of the selfish motivation per se, is driving why people are willing to pay those private costs to achieve the greater public goods before for protests to become something that can induce changes.
I've seen a lot of research about protest movements in high-income countries, less about protests in Global South. I would have thought that they might be different in character.
That's very much consistent with what we observe. I think we try to conduct more or less apples-to-apples comparison as much as we can between what regions academics have studied and where we see protests in our large-scale database. And we do see some places substantially overrepresented in the academic literature and others underrepresented. And I think the places that are overrepresented seem to be places where academics have experience, countries that are relatively large, that have infrastructure and relatively strong states, even if those states are quite autocratic. So the US, China, and Russia are disproportionately studied by academics relative to the prevalence of protests. And as you say, places that are relatively fragile politically and maybe also dangerous are understudied. And I think you're right to say that there's reason to think that protests could be different. The reaction of states such as they are will naturally be different depending on whether the state is very strong and capable or fragile. And so we really point to that gap as a crucial area for work, although we acknowledge that it's a difficult space to work in as a social scientist engaged in human subjects research, because it can be really dangerous and ethically challenging as well to study protests and protest participation in these contexts.
Difficult, as you say, but where would you like to see more research?
One of the settings where it was very underrepresented in academic research relative to the actual political movements or protests occurring on the streets is the Israel-Palestine context. To our knowledge, there hasn't been that much research both happening in the past, but also ongoing research in that context. And certainly relative to the general media's attention to that, relative to the importance of that to global politics, I think that would deserve a lot more study. And the challenge of study that is probably even higher compared to the other underrepresented settings, but that should be encouragement for creative social science solutions to study that, maybe indirect proxies to study those protests rather than direct engaging with the human subjects per se. But I think those are definitely important and understudied areas where we would love to see more research on.
We are living, as it seems, through a period of political instability, political polarization, a lot of potential economic problems that come out of that. Do you think that protests are going to continue to be important to study? Are they going to get more important to study?
Well, we may be biased, and we are economists, which means that we may also be wrong. But if we think about protests as expressions of political grievance that isn't effectively expressed through voting alone, grievance that is expressed by people feeling disempowered or unrepresented, and finally, grievance that requires social coordination and therefore benefits from coordination and communication technologies, all of those trends seem, if anything, likely to become more pronounced. So I will say protests are more important than ever to study and will remain important.
I completely agree. And it's also a statement that while not every single protest are leading to successful, visible outcomes, the instances where a human race gather together on the streets and exhibit their power as a group of population that demand changes from autocrats, from dictators, or from some democratic regimes where the voice isn't heard through the electoral system, those are some of the most powerful moments and most sort of, I think, beautiful moments in the political history of human race. And that has been true for centuries and likely will remain true, if not more true, going forward. So protests are important historically, post-protests important in the past, and they're going to remain sort of at least equally important as a demonstration of human power going forward.
More often at this point in a discussion, I ask, what are the policy implications of this? It's not quite so obvious in this case, not least because we naturally talk about protests as a sort of expression of discontent with an authoritarian government that refuses to engage. If we can think of it in a slightly more positive way, are there some lessons that come out of this for a government to learn from this rise in protest about maybe how to engage a little bit more with their citizens, maybe have some kind of dialogue, which means protests are less necessary?
Yeah, I think there is something to learn from the experience of protests and the observation that protesters do impose costs mm-hmm. on non-protesters, but they also are often paying high costs themselves. And I think governments that recognize that the protest action is an expression of a really intensely felt political position, as well as often a feeling that that position can't be expressed through more formal channels, suggests responses. And that's not to say that the responses are easy or should just be immediate concession or anything simple like that. But the response should involve listening to groups that don't have necessarily an easy access to power or influence, and at least trying to engage with the ideas that are so passionately expressed by the protesters. The ideas that are so passionately expressed that people pay high costs to express them are ideas that ought to be taken seriously, if not always agreed with.
This is very important research. I'm sure we'll be discussing it again. Thank you, Noam.
Thanks so much, Tim.
And David as well.
Thank you very much.
The article is called Protests. It's published in the Annual Review of Economics, number 16. That's a 2024 publication, of course. The authors, David Cantoni, Andrew Cao, David Yang, and Noam Yuchtman. Also, if you want to look up the book that Noam was talking about, Twitter and Tear Gas, then the author is Zeynep Tufekci, and that was published in 2017. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. If you like what you're hearing, then please leave us a review. Tell someone else about us.